And they are conversations with artists and curators, and I usually chair this series, and I'm delighted today to be staging a conversation with Sebastian Lopez, who is currently now our new director of INIVA, the Institute for International Visual Arts in London. So welcome everybody, I'm very glad you can be here. Conversations, as we all know, take many forms, and this evening's conversation will be structured for about the first part of the conversation. I'm going to conduct a conversation with Sebastian by talking about what he's done, asking Sebastian questions about different initiatives, different projects, different exhibitions, what he envisages for INIVA. And then in the second part of the conversation, we'll open it up to everybody for you to also pick up from that, ask new questions and develop the ideas. I think that the event, usually the conversations last for about an hour and a quarter, something like that, and they're rather different to the longer lecture format that usually takes place here at Train. But first let me introduce Sebastian. I mean, many of you will know him, and you will have encountered his work as a curator, as a writer, as an artistic director. His career, you'll know, now director of INIVA. He was director of the Gate Foundation in Amsterdam. He's been director and curator of the Darros Foundation Museum for Contemporary Latin American Art. And he has an international reputation as an artistic director, an innovative curator, and a writer of major significance. He's published many books, including On Postmodernism, Talking Back to the Media, A Short History. He's published a raft of exhibition catalogues around really innovative curating, particularly in the Netherlands, starting from an exhibition in 1984, Refugees in the Netherlands, History of Video Art, Double Dutch, Shall I Stay, Shall I Go? He's been involved in co-curating, notably the East exhibition in Norwich in 2000, which many of you may have seen, which he co-curated with Keith Piper. He was one of the curators of the Shanghai Biennale in 2004. I want to ask you some questions about the exhibitions that you've curated. Most recently, drawing on the Darros Latin America collection, you've recently curated what I think is a really fascinating exhibition. I've only seen the publications from it. I haven't seen the exhibition called The Hours, Visual Arts of Contemporary Latin America. You're also a conference organizer. You've done many conferences. You're someone who's great at getting other people to come together to talk, to debate temas centrales, central themes, which brought together people who are concerned in Central American art. And I often think of you as somebody who's a very good initiator of key debate. You're also, of course, an art historian. Sebastian taught at the Art History Institute in Amsterdam, where I am now based, so it's very nice for me to follow. And I know from that you're also a very gifted and inspiring teacher. There are many people in Amsterdam who speak very warmly about having attended your seminars and going to your lectures. In this conversation, I'd like to talk to you, Sebastian, about what you have done, what you want to do in the future, the directions that you have for yourself, and also for INIVA. And because this is a conversation taking place at Train, I'd like to put into these debates that factor of the transnational, or for you at INIVA, the international, and to ask you maybe what that means for you. It's something that shapes all of our lives in very different ways, but perhaps to ask you about your particular personal and professional thinking about the concepts of the transnational. So let's begin with curating. You've curated many exhibitions, solo shows for artists, retrospectives, major first shows in Europe, thematic exhibitions, issue-based exhibitions. You've curated in the Global South and in the Global North. Why is curating an important activity for you? Why do you work as a curator? What is it that curating can do for you? We just would like to ask you about this field of curating.
And
what can you do for curating,
I am from a time in which we did not use the word curatorship. Mm-hmm. where I would not say that curators did not exist, but what we did is what we used to call it, we were organizing an exhibition, putting together an exhibition, and so. So this extreme consciousness that we have today, where you have even, you know, complete departments of the university training people to become a curator, were different. In fact, when I curated the first exhibition, I think I was 19 years old. And curatorship, you know, was something that people were practicing in American museums. Because, you know, and I was born in Argentina. And in Spanish, we use the same name as in French, and he's a conservator of a museum. In any case, for me it was very important. I have been working in New York from 79 to 81. And I had a very traditional training as an art historian. I mean, I was trained that I will do a research in order to write an article, eventually, if the research is rich enough, you know, a book, and that's it. And when I was in New York, it was very, I was working in an apartment in New York University, in the NYU. And the seeing my colleagues working, learning and how some others, art historians, were working in museums. It opened up my mind in something that maybe today the day could sound so stupid, but that I could do a research and I could practice art history, not only, you know, implemented in an article, but it could be extended to many other things. That could be to do an exhibition, I don't know, a television program, a radio program, all things that I have done after that. And in fact, I embraced that, you know, openness, you know, and it changed my life, as it were, because after that, after working in New York, I went to work in Amsterdam University, and I tried to encourage that the students, and I organized a couple of things in which I introduced them in order to give them some training and some experience, and trying to open up also for them, you know, the possibilities. So this is the way I started working in curatorship, yeah.
But do you think curating allows you to communicate with particular audiences in particular ways? Is that communication with the audience important for you as a curator?
Sadly. But what is interesting about curatorship is that the format that you have, you know, the format of an exhibition, and there is not one single format for exhibition, you know. You have the format of a solo exhibition, which is one. You have the format of a group exhibition. You have another format that many people still until the day of today don't think as a format, which is a biennial format, which has been so strongly criticized the last years. But this is a very interesting way to put in together a discourse. And I think that what we do, we are not only framing what artists are doing, but at the same time producing discourse. Sometimes when you have the chance that the artist is working and living today, you know, together with them.
And when you work with artists, I mean, are there particular artists who you've most enjoyed working with? I mean, are there particular selections that drive the kinds of curating that you're doing? Particular interests that you have?
I suppose I have I must have humors in the sense of I like to work with some artists who think a lot and who work with on heavy subjects and or subjects that touch some of the issues I have been working by myself. This is the way that I came to understand first and to work together with Mesha Gaba, who is an artist from Benin, who we met in Amsterdam. and he was developing in that moment a work which took him about 4 or 5 years about what he was calling the Museum of Contemporary African Art. And he developed, you know, very consciously as he was doing department by department of museum. So he did the first exhibition, which is the one I organized, was the entrance of the museum and the architecture of the museum. And another one was, you know, the museum shop, the exhibition room, and so on. But I had been very much interested in the format of exhibitions, as I was saying. So for me, it was a sort of natural way of work with him. With some others, I have the chance not to work directly, but to be, you know, in a very interesting dialogue that is not, didn't happen sometimes in a daily basis, because sometimes we have not seen each other for a long time. But I don't know if with people like Cindy Sherman, with whom I met in New York when she arrived to New York. But after so many, many years, I could introduce her work in an exhibition I did in Amsterdam. And after that, after when she decided that the very, very early pieces can become public, which were the ones when she was doing at the end of her studies. We presented that and other of her pieces when I did the Biennale in Shanghai. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that when I was just looking over the kinds of exhibitions that you've curated, as you said, you've done themed or issue-based exhibitions as much as solo shows. One of the things that often seems to cross many of these exhibitions is an interest in questions about cultural diversity, which obviously still preoccupying you as director of Innover. But and the other question that you also seem to be very interested in is video art. And mm-hmm. when you did the short history, you said the history of Dutch video art cannot be understood nor explained without the contribution of artists from a diversity of cultural backgrounds living and working in the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands today, I mean, as here, there's this big debate about cultural diversity and these terms like migrant art, migrant aesthetic, migratory aesthetics are very much in the air. I mean, how do you place yourself within those debates? I mean, what do you think about terms like migratory aesthetics or migrant art or cultural diversity?
I don't debate about these subjects any longer. And because I after working on that subject, and mostly after living in the Netherlands for such a long time, I mean, I have been living there for about 27 years.
Yeah.
I've been myself, you know, a migrant, you know, not only in Europe, but particularly in the Netherlands. You realize that what we have decided to call multiculturalism is a cultural battle. It's not a question of discussion, but it's a cultural battle for the visibility, the recognition of the works of so many artists, not only in the Netherlands, not only in places like London, but in many other European places. When I did a short history, it was in a very important high moment of that political battle, you know, in the Netherlands. You know, quite important changes had happened politically in the country. And it was the Dutch Center for Media Studies, which was the joint, the putting together of two centers that were before. One was called Time-Based Arts, and I was one of the founders of Time-Based Arts. And Montevideo was called the other center. The government put money together and they created the Dutch Center. And they have decided to celebrate the 30th years of the practice of video art in the country. And I proposed them that I would like to join another team, but we from the Gay Foundation where I was working, you know, we will organize an exhibition, because I have studied quite a lot about the development of video art in the Netherlands, and I knew very well what I was doing. Because if you take, if you have a little knowledge of what happened in the Netherlands, you make a list of the highlights of the Netherlands Dutch video art in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and all of them are foreigners. So it was a way of saying, you know, publicly, what are we talking about? What kind of issues are we discussing? That in a moment in which, you know, media has become one of the most practiced, you know, medias by young artists, very much in fashion, in museum, in exhibition halls, and so on. And here you have, and for me it was very important because it was not only that the foreign artists were practicing, they were also excellent. Mm-hmm. They were the ones who created the fair galleries where video pieces could be seen. The ones who established the media departments in almost all the School of Visual Arts in the Netherlands. The one who developed the first magazines on that subject and wrote on that subject. And the ones who curated exhibitions to develop that. So, you know, it's not only, you know, that they have been practicing, but they have developed quite a large, you know, amount of activities around that. So for me it was very important, you know, in terms of, you know, how, this is the reason why I'm saying, you know, we did it, that particular exhibition in purpose, and it was very interesting that it was completely silenced in the Netherlands. And in contrast with that, we have an enormous success internationally with that exhibition. The exhibition was requested, you know, we didn't plan it like a touring exhibition, but we started receiving requests from other museums, you know, as diverse as in Reykjavik, in Czechoslovakia, in China, and it has been shown in the Central Reina Sofia, the Museum Reina Sofia in Madrid, in many, many other places. So coming back to your question, I mean, this sort of consciousness about what is put aside in a particular history. Now, one thing that was for me very important, that was way back in the early 80s, is that I was researching for my own PhD, which was on Torres Garcia, who is an artist originally from Uruguay. His father was a Spaniard from Catalonia who went there at the end of the 19th century. When he personally was about 17, his father has enough of Latin America and decided to go back to live in Barcelona. And there is where he started painting, became one of the important artists discussing the question that they call it in those days of modernism in Barcelona. And after that, he went to work in Paris, but in a particular moment, he was old already. He was more than 55. He decided to go back to Uruguay and to introduce one movement in which he was very much involved in Europe of developing, and that was basically constructivism. He not only said that, but he believed that constructivism as a movement was something that belongs to Latin America. He believed that the geometry, mostly of the visual arts, you know, that you can find in Peru, made and of constructivism, their language of modern art in Latin America. But researching mostly the time in which Torres Garcia was living in Paris, and that was during the 20s and the 30s, it was a shock for me because I didn't have the consciousness before that incredible amount of foreign artists working and living in Paris. So reading letters, which I did for my research, I was working also not only in his archive, but also in the archive of Mondrian and Van Doesburg. They were very good and very close friends. The enormous amount of, you know, Spaniards and Germans, you know, and Mexicans and Brazilians and Uruguayans and Argentinians and all of them mixed together, but at the same time all of them, and that is very clear in the autobiography that Torres Garcia wrote, how much he has, you know, touching pages about how much excluded they were from the whole art scene in Paris. So I went into researching that and that and that more, with quite a lot of interest, I must say. But one morning I wake up and I say, my God, but this is exactly what we are living today in the Netherlands. And I knew through some foreign friends of mine living in Germany that it was exactly the situation that they were living in Germany. So it was for me, you know, starting that research in the 20s and the 30s, finding, you know, that situation and that scene in Paris, that it allowed me or helped me to look, you know, with the, I need to say, you know, our historical eyes, you know, back to the present and what was the situation that we were in. I was participating in Amsterdam, for example, in places like Time Based Arts, you know, the next dean of the Chelsea College of Art is one also of the founders of this place. David Garcia is his name. We were all, you know, the Colombian from Mexico, from Greece, from Czechoslovakia, from Argentina, from Chile, from a lot of different sort of places, you know, working together there. So it was a sort of, you know, finding my present through history, if you want, but the present that was very much close to you, and realizing that many, many people didn't want to see that sort of reality. When I did my very first exhibition in the Netherlands, it was an exhibition on refugees artists. Many people told me, what are you doing? Why is it that? And but in fact, you know, when you realize that most of the European modern artists have been refugees, you know, like Mondrian, but we don't call him in that particular way. So I wanted, you know, to create a link with what happened in the past.
That has many resonances, I think, for many of the work that people are doing here,
yeah.
The kind of exchange, particularly this moment in Europe in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
Of
now,
intense
if I might interrupt the board, at the same time, I mean, that appeared in such a way to me. It also happened because I am a political refugee,
yeah.
Myself, and you know, I have many friends of mine until the day of today, you know, who are writers and visual artists and filmmakers, were political refugees from Argentina,
yeah.
Or from Chile, some of them. Some others are were political refugees from Uruguay. So these were questions which were very much related to my private life, if
yes,
you want,
yes.
But not isolated, you know, shared by a quite large group of people.
Yes, and that sense too that what one discovers in the past is still going on in the present, as you were saying. Do you have that sense? You talked a while ago about a sense of a cultural battleground. Of that moment that you experienced in the Netherlands.
I think we still are in the middle of the battle.
And how does the battle differ in London to how the battle you experienced in Amsterdam? Or how do you see the cultural landscape here?
I think that in London you have a longer history of artists participating in the battle. I mean, if you look back in how artists in London and outside London has been making groups together, you know, black artists getting together, and you know, if you think only about the group around Keith Piper, who start, you know, getting together already when they were students, and developing so many things in media, for example. Not to mention, you know, filmmakers working on that, many writers, much more than in the Netherlands, you know, writing about the history of black art in this country, or just reflecting what was going on in that particular moment. You know, the fact that one day, you know, Rashid Arain had the possibility to develop an exhibition, you know, in the Highworth Gallery, called Another Story. But at the same time, one or two years later, to develop, you know, a new magazine, mm-hmm. and which has quite a lot of consequences, we used to look with envy to that this to that history from the Netherlands, because we didn't have that. We were much more, I don't know, oppressed, suppressed, not having the possibilities to talk in that eloquent way. It could be seen also, but I'm just guessing, you know, that for the particular situation of the particular way that here in the UK colonialism has been developed, that it gets another touch. Maybe the colonialism of the UK has been in relation to these subjects, most of them, you know, post-colonials, you know, much more violent, probably, that they need to react in such a way, or much more excluded, you know.
No, I
don't know, but I am conscious that this history in the that here is much longer, you know, and with this mark, which are quite interesting, we had one group only. Oh God, was in 1998 probably in Rotterdam, of black artists getting together for the first time and writing a manifesto. But most of them were from the groups of theatre, not of the visual arts. Some visual artists were in between. But after writing the manifesto, they didn't do anything.
When, I mean, Iniver comes out of that landscape, those debates that took place in Britain in the 80s, particularly the conference Global Visions of 94 that Iniver was founded in. But now it's more than 10 years ago that Iniver's founded. And, you know, when you were appointed to Iniver, You said, and this is on the Iniver website, Iniver opened up questions more than 10 years ago that today everyone has realized are relevant. I am ready to enlarge its significance and investigate new roots. In a cultural climate in which diversity and identity have been transformed into a carnival of exotic names and where issues that really matter are put aside, how do you see Iniver, Iniver's future, where Iniver's going, and I mean, out of the way it was founded in the 90s and the way that the cultural landscape has changed such a lot. I mean, where do you think Iniver is going now? And in relation to what you call this kind of carnival of exoticism, and I mean, it's both a kind of exotic display on the one hand, a kind of over-visibility on the one hand, that Gene Fisher's talked about, this super-visibility that black and Asian artists are brought into, or on the other hand, where issues that really matter are put aside, so this sense of exclusion and silencing. Perhaps could you talk about something about, you know, your sense of where Iniver might go now in that kind of landscape?
But let's not forget that Iniver was an initiative of the Arts Council. I mean, in difference with other initiatives that we have before. Now, for example, we got a beautiful building designed by David Adje that we share together with Autograph. I don't know if all of you know, Autograph is an agency for black photographers and human rights. But Autograph is coming, you know, for an activism, if you want, of photographers who feel themselves excluded, wanted to gather for. But Iniver come from a much more, you know, I will not call it governmental, but, you know, decision within the offices of the Arts Council, you know, that something like that could be possible. So that, without taking, you know, much consequence of that, but it's important, you know, to sign it out that this is like that. When I say that, when we opened the building last year, is mostly because I start realizing that from time to time, in some institutions, and in some European countries more than in others, it will be not so much on fashion, but it will be, you know, suddenly the Ministry of Foreign Affairs have a little money to do something with Central America. Why don't we invite a Panamanian, you know? Or, you know, let's do a black month or a slavery month as it happened in London. So, and normally when that happened, you know, you see from the government side and the agencies related with the government, you know, that some extra money will be put for that, you know. Let's do a Brazilian month, you know. They are going to do it next year in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam. So if they do something, they will do in relation to that extra money.
Yeah.
And that has been going on for a very, very long time. So in contract with that, you know, when I have the chance to talk with my some of my colleagues, you know, directors of some museums, I normally say to them, you know, today the day without any problem, you know, I don't believe what you're doing, you know. The day that you get the money from your own pocket, I will believe that you really want to engage yourself. The day that you don't get the money from an extra fund, but from the money of the museum, and you will buy works of these people for your own collection, I will believe that. So when I was talking about that, I was referring for that situation, which is quite extended in Europe. Quite a lot of people are doing that. People are not collecting the works of artists. Some of them are put on the show, literally, but not in collections. And we do know how important it is, you know, that in some moments some works are going to be collected, or we are going to have that particular memory, what collections are about that sort of questions. Another thing that was for me important is that I realized, it was mostly because the sort of work I had been doing directly with some artists, so, and being quite much engaged with them. And when you do so, you realize that they are not working in a ghetto. Their friends, they don't ask their friends where you come from. And I was remembering, you know, when I have these experiences, you know, until today, I remember how it was, you know, for Mondrian, you know, to become a friend of this Torres Garcia that I was researching. How it was for Diego Rivera from Mexico to become a very good friend. He was also the neighbor of Mondrian. So, and they were getting together, and I think that is the case in many, many times with many contemporary artists, that they get together with other friends without regarding their nationality because they believe in the same sort of artistic ideas, and they go together in a dialogue, you know. So I say, if that is the reality of the practice of the artist, you know, in today, why should we make separation of these discourses? And for that reason is that when I was appointed and I was talking with the board of the INIBA, I was saying, listen, this is what I believe, but I told them what I'm telling you now. And in the name of INIBA, certainly what I'm going to underline is going to be the word international. Meaning by that, you know, this confluence of discourses, you know, that it will be good, I think, I hope I'm not wrong, when you throw it in publications, in an exhibition space, all of them together in the same way that they are rising, all of them together. So you will not need to be surprised if in this year and probably next year, you are going to see, you know, we are opening an exhibition. You are very welcome if you want to come. The 12th of June, that's a Thursday, an exhibition of an artist from Colombia, Oscar Munoz is his name. But we are also working, you know, with artists from, which is going to happen probably next year, from Singapore, from Vietnam, from Taiwan, and from South Africa, from many other places. They get together in group exhibitions. They are invited, you know, many times in this biennial form, you know, to show together. And they get together and they go to have drinks together, and they go to dance together, but they also talk about what are they doing, and they let themselves influence, as it were, you know, by what they see in that particular context. Thanks God, you know, flight tickets are cheaper, you know, and an artist who is coming from the middle class can travel much more than you know, 20, 30 years ago.
One of the things that you did at the Gate, which I think was very important too, was that that you collated archives, you collected huge archives of artists,
yeah.
And I mean, and you created an exhibition about the archive and indexicality.
Yeah.
You were very keen on the library, and those are some of Iniva's existing strengths. So how do you think that kind of that collation, documentation, archival work will go forward? I mean, is that part of the project?
The structure of Iniva.
No, just in
it
kind
was
of
the structure of the Gate Foundation in Amsterdam.
It's
exactly
it.
The same.
Yes.
When I'm trying to find more money now in order to extend the archive.
Mm-hmm.
We have an archive, but also to, you know, to make a good study, to make it digital, and to make it much more accessible to people. We have wonderful things in the archive, and many people, they don't know. You know, sometimes it's easier to make everyone aware of the books you have in your library that the papers that you have in the archive. I don't know, for any one of you who would like to research, we have the complete archives of City in the Move, which has been one of the leading exhibitions presenting the works of artists from different cities, from different Asian cities. And because Iniva has such a good relation with Wuhan Ru, who was the curator, one of the curators of the show, we have the complete archive of City on the Moon.
Yes.
You know, that could give today the day that, you know, so many exhibitions has been organized, particularly this year, about Chinese art.
Yes.
You know, a quite interesting thing to look back to see what that was and how it happened. You will need to learn some Mandarin, by the way, but it will be maybe worthwhile. But I don't know. I have personally always been passionate by libraries. My father has a very large library at home, with a librarian, and so, and archives, which I discovered when I study art history. So, and I know how important and how rich that is in terms of knowledge, you know, the things that we can learn from that.
And the things that we can pass on to the future. I mean, the point that you made a little while ago in the conversation is also about the importance of collecting.
Right.
That if we don't collect now, that there will be no archives for the future. So and that we will not be able to transmit knowledge into the future. So it's also about a kind of wonderfully utopian belief that there will be a future, that the archive can inherit.
Yeah, I'm trying now to convince some people who have been, you know, to try to have the hard disk of their computers and to buy the hard disk of their computers in order to have it in our archive. I think there could be, you know, nowadays that we don't have, you know, these letters interchange any longer than if you go through, you know, internet and so on. Probably there are some of them could have very important material there. So my idea is to enlarge. One of the first things I did when I was at Iniva is that before Iniva you needed to make an appointment in order to go to the library. And now it took me a couple of weeks, I need to say, to convince everyone, you know, now we are in a building which is a public building, we need to have a public library. So now everyone can go there, but the consequence has been, and I was very happy because that in a period of 2 months' time, we have the same amount of visitors that the years before in 1 year time.
Wow.
So it means that it was really a necessity, and one of the things I did is we did it 2 months ago. We appointed an assistant librarian, which was really necessary. Quite a lot of people are going to use it there. It's very much a library for research, I would say. It's quite specialized, as you know. But I mean, I increased the amount of the budget of the library so that we can buy more books,
mm-hmm.
and that we can enlarge the archives. We just received a very new archive. It's an archive from an organization that you probably know if you are from the UK. It's called Engage. It's an organization who works with art education. And we are receiving officially the archives this week. And I think that it will be very interesting to have also this sort of archive. You know that art education has become one of the major issues in almost all museums and centers dedicated to visual arts. sometimes in the wrong way, I need to say, because sometimes they do some things that they call art education, but they are not. But anyhow, you know, there is, you know, and particularly here from the UK, because, you know, way back in the 19th century, it has been in the UK the only country in Europe where very extended programs of art education has been developed.
And if you talk to artists who've been trained in the past 20 years, I mean, for many of them, art education has been not only a training in art, but also a training in politics. I mean, the two have often gone together. Before you worked in Inverno, and between the Gate Foundation and Inverno, you worked in a very different climate, context.
Yeah.
You talked a lot about Inverno being publicly funded, and you worked for a private foundation.
Yes.
Can we turn to working for...
How did I tend to work with private foundation?
Yeah, and the work that you did, and you worked with a collection,
which
is a very different project. You work with people who are collecting art. So,
this is a collection from Zurich, still a collection from Zurich, from two privates and two people. They are married. Schmidt Heine is their family name. And they had a collection that they inherit, a beautiful collection of European and North American art from the 50s till here. The pieces they have in that collection, they are just amazing. You know, it's the best collection of early Andy Warhols. I mean, if you want to make an exhibition of Andy Warhol, you need to go there. You know, the collection of works they have from Louis Bourgeois, there must be in the collection some 250 pieces of Louis Bourgeois.
Mm.
There must be some 35 Andy Warhols, Ryman, Rauschenberg, many artists. The Joseph Beuys that probably you have seen at the Tate Modern. Have you seen the Tate Modern? There's one room with a big installation of boys that is from the Darris collection. Anyway, but they have many, many, many important pieces. In the year 2000, they, because Stefan and his wife and Ruth, both of them had been very much attached to Latin America. Stefan has his very first working experience in Brazil, and he speaks Portuguese. He and his wife, they speak wonderful Spanish. And they had also, because they are businessmen, he is a businessman, quite a lot of business in Latin America, even though they have changed through the last 20 years their business, and they are much more working in questions already for about 20 years related to ecology. Because their attachment they have with Latin America, they decided in the year 2000 to form a Latin American collection with the idea that that collection will be in one moment put on view in Latin America. And that thing, I like it very much. I mean, to help to develop a collection, not to kidnap it, you know, in a depot, in a storage building in Zurich, but from the very beginning, go on thinking, how can we make this collection available, you know? And for me, that was very important. So it was not just a collection. It was a collection with a very particular touch. Secondly, is that we decided that the collection that we were going to be building will be made public continuously, and we will dedicate quite a lot of effort through our own relations, the people that we knew in the art world, to make them aware about the collection eventually that they can show it. It is, I think, thanks for that, which took it was quite intensive as in terms of working hours, that, for example, some pieces of the collection has been introduced in Documenta in Kassel 2 times already. In the Documenta 11 that Okui Enfeso was directing, and in the last one, in Venice, in Havana even, in many, many other places, but also in temporary exhibitions. So it was not only about, you know, collecting, he was collecting and showing the pieces, not only through our own initiatives and our own exhibitions, but also giving others the possibility to come and without any interference to make a selection of pieces, and they could make their own exhibition. It happened already 3 times. From that is that from the from 2002 that we start looking. It was, I mean, it's crazy to say, but it's a luxury. On another hand, you know, we had the possibility and we did have the money, you know, to look where in Latin America we want to have this museum. You know, it's a luxury that not. So we had, we not only thought quite a lot, but many places had been visited. The first idea was to open it in Havana, in Cuba. Thanks God we didn't do it, because the policies of the government of Cuba have changed quite a lot, mostly in the areas of culture in the last 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. And we have the second option, which I still think is quite interesting, to open in Bogota, in Colombia. Mm-hmm. But at the end, we decided to open in Rio de Janeiro. So they are constructing now. Mm-hmm. And they hope to open the doors next year in May.
So can I talk to you about the Hours, this exhibition?
Yes.
That you recently curated? And you said that for you in curating it, you took the theme of time.
Mm-hmm.
And the time of day, particularly the time of the Latin American day, the mornings, the siestas, the afternoons. And then you kind of took that a little bit further and brought in Borges and the kind of question of time in his writing. How did that theme emerge to you as a theme that seemed one that would open up this collection to a particularly European audience? Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that theme?
Because I love the work of Borges first, but also because I have a perception, you know, the question of time in the work of Borges, which is this Argentinian writer, has been touched before, mm-hmm. but mostly because Borges has wrote a philosophical essay, a metaphysical essay, talking about the metaphysics of the question of time. Mm-hmm. But what I found to me, or to my mind, much more interesting and touching, it was the way that time appeared in his fictional work, mm-hmm. and in his poetry. The way that he described, you know, an afternoon, the way that he described walking with a friend through the streets of Buenos Aires, when he goes and sets the narration in the Pampas, you know, how that he normally introduce issues and questions of time, not only in the narration itself, but also in the way that he describes situations, or he describes the face of someone. Time is going to appear, you know, as a metaphor of that. Secondly, and that's the reason why I came to this, you know, to define the exhibition as, you know, the exhibition is intended as the mornings, the siestas, the afternoon, and the evenings of Latin American art. Because that allowed me to recognize that in Latin America we have different traditions, different artistic regions, I would call it, which they are very distinctive. And they are quite different one to each other. I mean, I was referring before, you know, that when Torres Garcia went to Uruguay, went back to Uruguay, you know, with a flag of constructivism is the art of Latin America, because the Indian culture of Latin America is geometric by nature, you know. That was not the only voice in those days in Latin America, you know. You have the very strong voice of the Mexicans, for example, who believed in something completely different. And their attachment, you know, to the so-called Indian population of Mexico was from different sort, which was much more, you know, because of their economical, political situation, that they are artistic, even though they took some things which had to do, you know, with their artistic heritage with them. So you have, you can recognize in Latin America, but Latin America is not the only place. You can see that also in Asian countries. You know, different formations of traditions of the modern. Because in one moment I got tired to talk about Latin America, you know, because immediately, sometimes you use it, and I use the word, you know, just for economical reasons when you want to communicate with someone. But on the other hand, there is one moment in which, you know, the word does not allow you to say everything you want to say. And in fact, you know, just going back, you know, to that, you can see that a very interesting connection in between these ideas and constructivist ideas, to put it in a very general way. I use the word constructivism because Torre Garcia used it in his manifestos and in his association of artists that he created in Montevideo. But you can find it, you know, in Buenos Aires, in Montevideo, and later, you know, appearing in Sao Paulo and in Rio de Janeiro, in a very different way, you know, appearing in Venezuela and in Colombia. But at the same time, that has nothing to do with some traditions that you can find in the Pacific area, which are also quite fascinating, quite different, and very valuable at the same time. This, what I'm saying, you know, is no different with the different, there's no, you can establish a comparison sometimes with the way that you can find in literature in Latin America, you know, the way that artists are, you know, writers, you know, establish their principles. So for me, it was also to talk about time to talk about these different ways of developing what I call hypotheses of modernism in different Latin American regions. We normally think about everyone in Latin America speak only Spanish and Portuguese, but you know, in Latin America we have mostly in the Caribbean, it's one of the most fascinating places in the earth, you know, in the sense, you know, all the colonial cultures are represented in the Caribbean, you know, the Dutch, Spanish, you know, the English.
I mean, what I thought about that, I read your essay in The Hours, and it seemed to me that it allowed you to take this huge category of Latin American art and actually break it very subtly, using that thematic of time to break it down into different components, different metaphors, as you say, different chronologies, and then how that maps into different kinds of practice. And some of the practice, of course, is time-based, and you know, you're working both with time-based media and with and with much more static media. So it seemed to me to be a kind of interesting way of approaching that.
I wanted to give in one moment also an homage to Borges,
yes,
for whom not only the idea of time, he was, you know, a book freak at the same time. I think that probably
wrote wonderfully about the library.
Yes.
Yes.
And he was a librarian himself,
yes,
and so on. But anyhow, I wanted in a way to bring also an homage to him. So what I did is that the catalog also I developed as a sort of object in itself. So I was working with a designer, and he told me when we were preparing the catalog about an invisible ink that reacts to light. So in the catalog, there are some pages with some sentences which are now invisible, that I hope will go appearing little by little through time. Oh. In about 5-10 years time, when you open the book, you probably are going to find other texts inside.
Wonderful, that's truly Borgesian, yes.
There was little homage to the big man, yeah.
Yeah, but also, I mean, it's a way, I mean, if you think about his essay on the library, that in a way it's this, there is both the categorizing of the library, which of course you set out in the essay, but there's also in a way in which the excess of categorization in the end implodes on itself. And I think that's really exemplary too, of something that you show in that essay. I think you and I have probably been talking for quite a long time. It would be very nice to have questions from other people here. And we've touched on lots of issues which I know are very relevant to the interests of many people in the room. So, Michael. Can everybody, can you hear Michael at the back? Yeah.
I'll try to speak again. This discussion about Borges reminded me of a short story of his called, appropriately enough, this discussion, The Other, where he meets himself from the past. He meets his younger self. And it also reminded me of this, how this discussion began. About your art historical studies of Torres Garcia and realizing that actually this is me today, or the group, my group today. It's kind of an interesting crowd. But Deborah mentioned Jean Fisher's discussion about this kind of explosion of visibility. Art from non-European or non-canonical whatever you like to define while at the same time there's a kind of the key issues are hidden. Perhaps you could expand on your answer to that in terms of how Innova is attempting to deal with this issue of massive visibility that we have, especially in London. I think in Europe it's not quite.
It's less.
Yeah. But in London there is a massive visibility, but it becomes a kind of. This visibility can never quite escape. I think you described it as carnivalesque or exoticism. There's always a kind of a label attached to it. Perhaps you could kind of expand on
No, one more time. What I was referring is the way that, you know, when this appearance, you know, is there. And what I was trying to say also is that they are not there on a regular basis. They are not there as a part of a regular policy. But they appear when some extra money is coming, okay? And I hope that more is going to be appearing. But we also have, you know, I always remember what happened way back in the 80s with women artists. You know, women artists had been fighting for the presence of women in collections and in exhibitions of space for a very long time. And suddenly, I'm talking mostly about the European experience, they decided, this bunch of stupids, because they were just stupid, you know, we have arrived, we have what we wanted. So they dismantled, at least in you know, my experience in Amsterdam, women's studies at the university disappear, you know. Very important groups of oppression also disappear. And little by little, all these fantastic, you know, women groups disappear, you know, because they thought we achieved what we wanted. And you see, at least in the area that we work, you know, 3 or 4 years later, no one was invited to an exhibition in a museum. The museum were not buying their works any longer. But they just disappear, you know. I always remember that because is it that going to happen also with all these artists from different cultures? If we stop the pressure of discussing the issue, putting the questions in the best possible way, you know, to the public, are they going to disappear when we don't pressure the situation? This is the reason why I was trying to describe the situation. Like this is a political battle, yeah. Until when it's going to go. But if the political battle has been done mostly in what we have called a post-colonial, you know, which touch only but certain groups working in London. You can I discuss this issue with other friends of mine who were born in Latin America, you know. And even though when we could follow and understand very well the question of post-colonial culture, they were attached to a particular sort of countries related to England mostly, you know, because most of Latin American countries has been liberated politically, at least, from Spain way back in the 19th century. So it was a difficulty, you know, of relating with that. That doesn't apply not to remember that from that political relation with Spain, many Latin American countries enter into a second wave, you know, of occupying the country, which was mostly economic and later military, you know, from some European powers, you know. Even the Belgium were, you know, trying to introduce something in Latin America and they couldn't. But we have later, you know, the intervention of the United States and other power, political powers. So for when we were thinking that sort of questions in within the Latin American history, you know, modern history, we have been using other sort of parameters and so on. But anyhow, to come back to your question, I think that we do need to write more, to research more, to study more, and to publish more of that, to organize more exhibitions, seriously made exhibitions.
It seems to me that it's no longer a question of visibility, but a question of interpretation.
But you know, Michael, that is the nature of the contemporary museum. I mean, how museums function today to day. Because they know if they do something simple and not, you know, I'm not talking in terms of presentation, probably they will not get the public. Yeah.
But isn't Mike, can I just triangulate this conversation? Because one of the things that's very interesting, and I know that we've discussed in trained seminars, is this question of the canon. And there is, it seems to me, as museums move into these areas where they're getting Latin American curators, Indian curators, etc., is there a kind of canon of, particularly of contemporary artists, who are consistently coming to the fore and they're being promoted by big exhibitions, by big museums, and this means that there are other artists who are of equal artistic merit but aren't in this kind of super canon of international biennale museumified artists. So is it something like that that you were talking about, Michael?
I was thinking more in terms of critical discourse created around, but that what you've just described is also the case, and it's a case that is particularly so with a kind of complicity between large institutions and the market. It's kind of the art fair competing with the biennial and being kind of part of the kind of an equal player within the art circle.
But Michael, you just mentioned, you know, what the American museums are doing. In the United States, there are two museums working on that issue. You know, one is in Austin and the other one is in Texas. And it's not by coincidence that the only one, you know, who made the connection with that was Mari Carmen Ramirez, who worked first in Austin, and after that she went to work in Texas. So, how many other places, you know, you have, you know, Alma working in Los Angeles, you know, with the curator of Los Angeles Museum, but and now for the very first time, because it was paid by you know, one of the trustees of the museum, MoMA has a Latin American curator. At the new museum?
It used to be at the new museum.
Dan Cano.
Yeah. Kind of very strong curators, kind of star curators that have kind of incorporated this area. I wouldn't say that Mike Browning, but she's a very powerful person.
But she is the one I was thinking you were describing when you were saying, you know, massive books, well documented. This is what Mary Carver was doing, so just face it, we were there. But even if you count, you know, with one hand, in the United States, there are not many. It's a pity, you know. We have in one moment a very strong Chicano group, you know, theoreticians, historians, practicing artists, you know. And it has disappeared a little by little.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's exactly the problem.
I don't know if they monopolize the subject. They're working on that subject. And thank God they have the possibility to have some money for that. You know, I think that you are aware about the fact that Mari Carmen Ramirez did a secret, you know, but massive fundraising and bought this unbelievable collection from Sao Paulo based in constructivist pieces.
Yeah.
I say, excuse me, chapeau, as the French say. You know, this is an incredible work. It's a pity that went away from Brazil. But the Brazilians are fucking stupid because they don't take care of their artists. You know, it need to come from London, you know, that London discovered them, that two fundamental artists of the 20th century, you know, Oiticica and Ligia Clark, you know, were Brazilians. They did not do any research. I'm talking way back in the 70s and early 80s. And Galbraith need to come with a massive, important article to discover them and us, among others, you know, that these artists have been working wonderfully. But that has to do with the stupidity of the Brazilians. You know.
It's a kind of colonized mentality, but it's more or less the same issue I'm dealing with. It requires a foreigner to kind of declare these artists important. There were many people in Brazil and Rio defending Ligia Clark and Edward Seeger who were just ignored. The Caluzillo, Felipe Moraes, they had their kind of critics that were defending their work, but these people were kind of marginalized. And it's not until someone from outside comes and uses.
You know, in Latin, if we refer to Latin America, but I don't think Latin America is the only case. I mean, I have found the same things in Africa. If the news is coming from Europe, it seems that it's much more important if the news is coming from around the corner. And this is the consequences of the colonial past, I would say.
This is an issue that we can speak on global terms, but we can also speak on local terms.
Yeah.
Such as the relation between London and the Manchester, Liverpool, regional capital, which is something that you've already spoken about dealing with.
One of the things that I want to do with Iniba is that we have started already, you know, a series of visits. You know, because in Iniba, most of the artists have been shown in Iniba are from London, and from one or two communities in London. So now we have started a series of visits to Manchester, to Liverpool. We are going to go all the way to Wales, you know, in order to try to see what are they producing there, because artists living outside of London have much more difficulties, you know, finding a place to show in London. And I do know that there are very interesting artists working in Liverpool, in Manchester. Maybe there are equally interesting artists living in other places which I've never visited before.
Mm. I mean, I think that's certainly true. I mean, we can think of somebody like Lubaina Hamid, who's working in Preston, who's actually very, you know, I mean, working with issues of cultural diversity around Preston, Manchester, Liverpool, who's created lots of networks there, and quite local, which are really different to those the ones at Innover. So I think the local dimension is really, really important. Are there questions for Sebastian? Are there things you'd like to ask?
Or you just want to say something?
What? Yeah.
Or you just
want
to
say
something?
Disagree? Or?
Yeah, I have been working in some areas in Asia, but some areas only, you know. I started working in Chinese contemporary art way back in the 80s, and I have been in China many times and so on. I think that is what the Chinese have taken into consideration when they invite me to curate the biennial in Shanghai. But not only there, but also in, you know, in Vietnam, which is, you know, under very different sort of conditions, and in Singapore and in Malaysia too. I don't want to give the impression that I am a specialist of all over the world, because it's impossible and it's irresponsible if somebody would say something like that. So I do respect, you know, colleagues who are expending, you know, an enormous amount of time and research in knowing a little bit better, you know, what happened in African countries. I have worked with artists from Africa, from Benin, from Zimbabwe, from Angola, from South Africa, and from Mozambique already, you know, in the last 15 years or so. But I will never say that I am a specialist of that particular areas. Because working, and that was the very first time working with artists from Benin, and it was a whole interesting thing, because there were aspects of sides of the work that I didn't get it, and I didn't know why. It was nothing to do with the question of history of they have, but there were relations in the space, in the sort of objects they use it, which were absolutely out of my experience. And I wanted to make sense of that. Thanks God, around that time, you know, the first time I went to Benin, it was a book published, it was a translation, it was published in English, about African philosophy, which I found very interesting, and I bought it immediately. You know. Who in this earth will think that Africa has a philosophy and a philosophical tradition? So for me, it was, you know, just an eye opener, but on the other hand, you know, many philosophers working in different, you know, African countries and so, and it was this very particular and a very interesting chapter of a philosopher from Nigeria, very much influenced with the philosophy of language, and he was referring at the relation between language and the way that they perceive, you know, themselves, and they perceive nature. And he used, by chance, one example that for me was very, opened my eyes in order to see better what these artists from Benin were doing, because they were talking about, they were sharing the language of this Nigerian philosopher. And it seems that in their language, when they say, "I am," they use a construction in which they say, "I am in relation with this tree, I am in relation with this staircase, I am in relation to other sort of elements. And what I was looking then were some artists in Benin working with installation pieces, where the relations in space are fundamental, you know. And I don't know if I had seen it properly, that relations that was, you know, reading through Nigerian philosophers. But I will say that, you know, that I have colleagues of mine that I respect quite a lot, and they have spent much more time than myself of understanding, you know, what is modern and contemporary art in Africa and in some Asian countries. And I thank God, you know, I feel myself very privileged because I know them now personally, and I can learn from them, even having a coffee together, some new things. But I think that what make from the situation also extra complicated is that you find the development of modern ideas in a very different way in countries which have been colonized by the British, or in countries which have been colonized by the Dutch, or who have been colonized by the Spaniards or the Portuguese, because it seems that they have brought not only their own culture but their own perspectives, you know, in relation to modern time and modern ideas. You know, we do know today that in Britain have taken a long time until modernism really have some roots and some standing in this country. Very late, actually, you know. Latin America was much earlier in taking over, you know, the language of modern times in order to do visual arts of architecture. So from the artists I have worked together, and so, and coming back to your question, you know, for me it's very important, and I think I'm going to do that mostly, you know, inviting curators to create some show. I had the last month some talks with some colleagues from Africa, working and living in Africa, so that the say is going to be to them. I start working in something which is extremely expensive, and I don't dare to tell you because I don't know if I will be able to do it, because it will take so much fundraising. But I'm dreaming, you know, at least to do it once a year, to invite a center from Africa, let's say from Cape Town or from Angola, and to give them the space of Ineva so they can do in a month's time whatever they want to do. So that they can do the programming, they can do the exhibitions, they can do the discussions, they can do everything, you know. But I know what I am starting with, because this is extremely expensive, you know. I will need to bring not only the director, but, you know, the curators and the technicians and everyone else, and the artists they want to bring with them, and the philosopher they want to bring with them. So I don't know, but I really would like that, you know, that would be a sort of contribution of not handling, you know, other cultures. You know, Africans in particular have been contesting quite a lot to the fact that they are always curated from the outside, I mean, but they have never had the chance to do things by themselves, and they are right. You know, even though with some of the creators coming from the outside were Africans themselves, like Okwi and others, you know. But they resented that. They also resented the fact that, which we have not mentioned yet, that, you know, in this carnival of exotic names that we were talking before, many of the people invited the last year are people living in Europe, not living in Zimbabwe or not living in Hong Kong, you know. They profit, we know that it's cheaper, we have been talking about budgets and so on, but that doesn't mean that, because migrating cultures, they develop things in a quite different way, you know, and the people who remain at home, they also continue to develop things in their own way. I mean, I have that, you know, very strong when I go to visit my family in Argentina, you know, when the little kids, you know, when they are teenagers, and my nephews, they talk with each other, I don't understand a single word, and they're spoken in Spanish. So it means that not only language has developed, imagine in terms of much more you know, daily talk, much more complicated language, as is the language of visual arts, you know, they have developed in a different way. But it will be nice, you know, to that, and it will be the only possible way, you know, that to introduce, you know, with all the limitations, probably, because Michael was also referring, you know, at the sometimes, you know, you cannot see the things that happen around, you know, your own place, or you have a different perception, you know. Probably an artist that we consider interesting looking from Europe, they will not consider interesting, and they will prefer somebody else, you know. You have these kind of local celebrities, you know, but probably they, if we do that, you know, invite, they will come with one of the local celebrities that probably will not be the best one, but that is the way that they choose, and that is the way that they develop their discourse, you know. Oh, I'm having a question today. I mean, the next exhibition is for Colombian artists. And you know, for immigration purposes, you know, and for costumes, you know, any Colombian artist is a potential drug dealer. we were very nervous last week because we are, you know, bringing some pieces. Some pieces from Oscar from Bogota, sorry, from Cali, where is he living? And, you know, are not arriving yet, and we were expecting they will arrive this week. So they are probably going to test it, you know, extra. I don't know if you know the story about Doris Salcedo. You know, the artist, the Colombian artist who just did the Turbine Hall here at the Tate. Doris was invited late 80s to do a solo exhibition in New York. And that was a moment in which she started working with these pieces of furniture. I don't know if you have seen it in the White Cube. They have some new example of it. So they are pieces of furniture that she worked out with other materials and with plaster and so on. So she worked, you know, it was her first exhibition in New York. So she was working like crazy, you know, to do the best possible job. When the sending arrived in New York and they saw that it was coming from Bogota, costumes destroyed the complete exhibition because cocaine could be inside. So the exhibition couldn't take place. So we are much aware about this kind of thing. It is not only, you know, the question of visum and immigration papers. You are very right, you know, that in many countries we are still having a lot of problems. And we have in two ways, you know, the problems in bringing the artists here and problems sometimes to bring the works here, which are also very important.
I think, you know, in terms of like the big institutions, they could exert some kind of political pressure because, in a sense, they, you know, if there was from the institutions the will to really have these artists here to represent them on a regular basis, they should be starting immigration around these issues. So I guess what I'm pressing is just looking at the ways in which, you know, that battle of culture that you mentioned, that has to be fought on so many things. Some are very practical, which is that. And I think, you know, like you can say, oh yeah, we don't have those Africans to take over. But if they are not ensuring that there's the political pressure to make the situation of people a reality, then, well, we cannot have them. And I think last month they had to cancel a concert.
Yeah.
Because you think that these things happen only in South American African companies. Our trained member, Rebecca Solder, told me a story that a Japanese calligrapher who was sort of second in command of a very famous was invited to London to do a demonstration and went to the British Embassy and just checked. And the visa was refused. And we think what probably happened was that his English was not very good. And he said, oh, I'm going to teach. Right? And of course, teaching is working. So you can't just do that. And it was extremely embarrassing that the ambassador couldn't really discipline the junior person because he should be supporting the junior. And in the end, it was solved by Rebecca asking the MP. And the MP phoned the ambassador. And so because the ambassador said, oh, MP, what we have to do whatever the MP has to do, so he was in the end naked. So, and those stupid little things can suddenly blow up in his face. And if the calligrapher really couldn't make it, it would be a huge face loss. It would be really injurious to the whole, if it was a non-divine person. So, I mean, these things can happen.
Only with Japan, also with Japanese.
Yeah, Japanese venerable calligrapher.
Yeah.
Never mind about drugs.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to also ask, I was very interested about the language issue, like the African. Like in Japan, also Japanese, we slightly modify our language depending to whom we are speaking, to an older person, to women or children, or with subtle differences. But you said at the very beginning that the curating, the word actually didn't even exist when you started. And it's interesting, it still doesn't exist according to MS Word spell checker. Curating doesn't exist. Yeah. So it's interesting that in some, do you think sort of the curation itself has become also somehow a more high profile, also in one way, specialist job? That's the answer to the question. But also I was interested, very interested in what you wanted to do with Eva, just to give a space, but sort of pull back and let them do it, which is almost sort of...
No, it's not to pull back, it's just to let them talk.
Yeah.
Pass them the microphone. You know, and not have it for yourself the whole time.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. So you don't...
Pass it back through the boxers, because you know you need to hear whether they're talking.
I found also a very interesting case was the Fukuoka Asia Museum. When they built it, because they had a very long tradition of the city museum to buy and do sort of exhibition of Asian contemporary art, not just individual countries. And then finally they had enough collection that they built it. And when they built it, they insisted that they would have artist workshop built into the museum so that actually the interactivity, so citizens can go there, and they do quite a lot of sort of jamboree and festivities, and just sort of the non-high cultured, highbrow art people are actually selling, and then very all Asians. You see, so Fukuoka as a gateway to Asia. You see, it's very much the city fathers also encourage, and so that sort of seems to work. But I'm interested in sort of a future of curatorship in a transnational context. How do you sort of see? Is it all rosy or?
Yeah, no, it's not difficult because, you know, just seeing what something I mentioned before, you know, in the same time that we have so many school of visual arts, you know, and we are in one of them, you know, you cannot avoid it, you know, producing so many future artists, that, you know, visual arts is going to continue, you know. It's not by chance that we have such an enormous presence today, the day of what we call contemporary art. We never, ever have so many artists in the world like we have today, you know, and probably it's going to happen exactly the same with curatorship, now that we have so many schools of curatorial studies, you know. And there are some of them, you know, not as much as the School of Visual Arts, which have a very long tradition, but there are many, which you can think that, you know, in the next years, quite a lot of things are going to happen in terms of curatorship. I think that will continue. And you know, more and more articles are appearing today by people who try to describe what happened in the last 15, 20 years. They say that it will be much more proper not to discuss it in terms of artistic movements, of artistic discourse, because they say, you know, that has disappeared, and instead of that, we need to talk about the period of exhibitions. So the exhibition as such, done by an artist or done, you know, curated by a professional curator, you know, it seems that has taken the much more role in terms of discussions, interchange of ideas, that what we used to discuss in terms of form, color of space, you know, way back in the 70s, early 80s, probably. There has been, you know, wonderful publications done for that. But it's interesting that there is a perception that the last years, no many things have happened. I do think that many things have happened, but many people think that not many things have happened in the visual arts. So the major statements are made, you know, is certain sort of exhibitions. Some of them, you know, are quite a big name, you know, as exhibition, you know. I mentioned before, you know, Cities in the Move, among others, but it's not the only one, you know. You have, you know, infamous, you know, exhibitions like Les Magiciens de la Terre, and others, which, you know, you single out as something interesting or as a reference point. But many colleagues of mine have been sometimes doing exhibition but not experimenting or not trying to find out what the phenomenon exhibition is about. I have tried to do it sometimes but not always. When I did the exhibition about the archives, that was an I wanted to introduce and to do two things at the same time. To introduce to the public the archive that we were developing at the Gate Foundation, and secondly, to discuss the question of transcultural relationships. So what I did is that I put the furniture of the archive, it was the exhibition room was a rectangle, the furniture of the archive was at the end of the room, of the exhibition room, and we changed the works of the exhibition space once a week, and some we even changed the position within the exhibition group, okay? On the other hand, at the side of the pieces were no reference, there was not the name of the artist or this kind of thing that we normally do in exhibition, and there was a number. And that was a number that corresponded with the archive. So if you were eventually interested in this artist, you could go immediately to the archive and try to find out, you know, more information about the artist and eventually connection with other artists that you didn't know before. So it was done in a, I tried to describe sometime in different circles that touch each other. One was the circle of the works, you know, rotating as it were in and out of the exhibition space, but also from wall to wall. The second was the one that I created for the public themselves. And the second one, it was the rotation of the art, the facts that you think that you have in the archive, rotating among themselves. And it worked quite a lot. The people working with me at the Gay Foundation, they wanted to kill me. Because they said, oh, they really an idea, but we never ever do an exhibition, because they needed to work quite a lot, because it was about 15, 20 exhibitions together in 3-4 weeks' time. But anyhow. But you know, this sort of experimenting on other ways of looking, doing, thinking. But at the same time, I'm extremely conscious that, you know, visual arts is extremely complex language, as I said before. Don't expect that I will do an educational program with such an exhibition, because it will be a disaster. You know, but we need to have the possibility to develop very thoughtful ideas that they are going to be understood by a couple of people interested on that only, probably. But they could eventually have consequences, you know. Some very interesting exhibitions which have been taking place, you know, in the way of installation, the display, the way that the role of the public who have been, you know, plan and so, has been, you know, fundamental. You know, I think that all of us have seen the pictures of the very famous exhibition of surrealism in New York, when the installation of the exhibition was done by Marcel Duchamp, when he crossed, you know, all the room by these strings, you know, avoiding that you could see fully one work and so on. And it was, that was, this is one of his, you know, I would call it a curatorial statement and display of an exhibition, which was very interesting. That exhibition in particular was not about surrealism, by the way. You know, it was about the arrival, you know, of refugees artists from Europe in New York. And the very complicated, you know, you also were mentioning, you know, the problem of visas and so on, the very complicated stories and difficulties they have, you know, to be able to arrive to New York. Some of them they couldn't, you know, in order to, you know, continue living and working. And sometimes I see that particular exhibition, like the strength of these enormous bureaucratic things that can avoid that you will be able, you know, to feel free or not. So we but I don't know, I think the creatorship is going to continue, I hope.
I think this conversation, sadly, ought to come to an end. We've been talking for nearly an hour and three quarters, and I just want to say we've almost finished up where we began on the question of curating migrant movement, transnational movement, questions about identity and institutions of government politics. We've covered a lot of ground. I just want to thank you all for being here. Thank you for your questions, and most of all to say a huge thank you to Sebastian, because
okay.
You've been so generous in talking about what you have done, what you think about the future, what you think for the present, and just to say a really big thank you. I think we've all really enjoyed listening to you today. Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Is that off?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. That was
thank
fabulous. Was that okay?
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Excellent.
Good.
It's exactly the way I want it.
Exactly the way you want it. We should have recorded that bit.
You know, easy and open.
That's great.
Huh? How are you? Nice to hear a story about Japan.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I have other
so
stories about it. Sometimes you know, you name the ones that you remember immediately because they were very close to me. But you know, I believe things with Africa and art, and we go other, you know, Asian countries.
And very often it's just that a very low-grade person in an embassy can make a mistake.
Yeah.
You see, and they think that they don't believe it enough. Just putting on. And it could have been.
I was talking with a friend of mine, and he's, you know, a French speaker from Africa. And in Curitiba, in French, they call it commissaire. But the chef is the also called commissaire. So they have a first problem with the last one. The guy that was put in and this guy, you know, was, you know, curating the exhibition and wanted to do that. How was it possible? He went there, you know, and said, listen, I am the commissaire of the art. And the commissaire said, my God, we are community. So he had, and he was the, you know, the general, the curator director of the whole thing. So he was the general commissaire. His two names related with the military thing. The guy was liberated in India. Don't you love it? I love it.
¿Cómo estás? ¿De qué? Mandé mi currículum y mandé mi...
Hablé con Naomi.
Ah, Naomi lo pasó.
Sí, quería saber si te había llegado.
Sí, me ha llegado.
Estoy súper interesada en poder empezar a trabajar con usted, si es posible, si tiene algún
Yo te vamos a contar. Hemos estado locos de trabajo con la exposición de Oscar que inauguramos ahora y estamos haciendo entrevistas con empleados nuevos en la sesión de finales. Así es donde nos lleva la cantidad de tiempo.
Pero empezar de repente a poco.
Me
gustaría trabajar como asistente curador o en el archivo.
Pero de las posibilidades de eso te vamos a contestar dentro de poco. ¿Está?
Súper bien. Sí, porque mi disertación es sobre el archivo, enfocado a Latinoamérica, tratando de hablar del archivo, pero en Latinoamérica, ¿qué está pasando en Latinoamérica?
Yo
estoy organizando un seminario, voy a invitar a Gerardo, yo también estoy empezando a invitar a My Bread y a Signo Meireles. Entonces la idea, me gustaría mucho ver la posibilidad de conectar esto con, no sé, con una experiencia en IVA.
¿Entiendes?
How are you doing?